Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to this week's edition of Web Sleuths Radio on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Tricia Griffith, co-owner of WebSleuths.com, one of the coolest true crime chat rooms, along with ForumsForJustice.org, another very cool internet true crime chatting area forum that you can go and discuss all of the true crime that's going on in the world. Now, I'm calling tonight's edition of Web Sleuths Radio the What the Hell edition. Professor P.S. Ruckman Jr. will join us in just a few moments. He is a professor of political science at Rock Valley College, Illinois, and Professor Ruckman has closely studied the pardons served up by former Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour. You know, those pardons that let out of prison killers. Not only let them out, but the pardons wiped out their criminal records so they could hunt. Oh, joy. See what I mean? What the Hell is the perfect title for our show tonight. And later on, Casey Anthony's psych evaluation was released. It said she wasn't crazy. She's not a sociopath. That is crazy. Again, perfect title, What the Hell. Now, helping us figure out Casey Anthony will be forensic psychologist Dr. Glenn Lipson. You can check out his great website at makingrightchoices.com. Along with Dr. Lipson is true crime author Donna Kaufman, whose latest book, From Crime Scene to Courtroom, features the Casey Anthony case. And they'll be joining us in just a minute. Web Sleuths Radio executive producer and director of the international division of Web Sleuths Mugs and T-Shirts, Kim Sturr, is with us. But first, Web Sleuths Radio is brought to you by a wonderful organization called DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. This is a nonprofit organization where their mission is to educate the public on child abuse symptoms, interventions, and preventions. Visit them at DreamCatchersForAbusedChildren.com. What the hell? It's time for the legal stuff. The opinions expressed on Web Sleuths Radio are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of WebSleuths.com, the website, which is a totally separate and different corporate entity altogether. So there. All righty. Now, let's get to it. What the hell? Professor P.S. Ruckman, welcome to the show, sir.
What a pleasure to be with you, Tricia.
Professor Ruckman, give us a little bit of background about yourself. Tell us how you came to be in this area.
Well, there are actually very few of us. You can almost count them on one hand that actively research this area. The others, most of them are lawyers. I'm a political scientist. I have a PhD in political science. And I was actually just kind of curious as to, I found out that Ronald Reagan pardoned 200 people back in about 1992 or 93. I learned this, and I was curious as to who they were. And I had so much trouble finding out who they were. It just kind of made me feel like I was onto something. And so I built a very large data set that goes from 1789 to right this second of every person ever pardoned by every president. And I share it with Judge Richard Posner, who sits on the Seventh Circuit here in Illinois. And I started a blog a few years ago, and I decided to start following state pardons as well. And so if something pops up in the states, as has in the case of Mississippi, I'm usually on top of it one way or another.
When you say on top of it, do you go on the internet and post about it, blog about it? If so, what is that address?
I have a blog called Pardon Power Blog. It's at pardonpower.com. And it's attained a reputation to the point now to where when something pops up in the states, usually I hear from journalists in the state almost right away. So, for example, for this Mississippi one, I was actually getting emails from journalists in Mississippi a week or so before Barbour left, before all this even happened, mm-hmm. Some of them anticipating and asking me about possibilities and what to look for and that kind of stuff. So the reputation of the blog has gone very well over the last couple of years.
Well, it sounds like you have found an amazing niche that nobody, I mean, I would never think of it, and what a great resource to have now. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Professor. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say it's an endlessly interesting thing, I find, too, because amazingly we forget these things. They're controversies. There's a tendency to consider them unprecedented, but it's amazing how history does repeat itself. I have presidential pardons of mafia gangland executioners, axe murderers, vampires, you name it. Bill Clinton's pardons were boring compared to what's
really?
Going on.
And yet
yeah.
They were so controversial at the time.
And we forget. They just go right off of our radar.
Let's let's get a little bit of background on the pardons and how they work and how they came about, and then we'll move to Mississippi. Were pardons the something that started at the very beginning with George Washington, or how did they come about?
Well, the pardon power itself stretches back as far as we know in terms of legal systems worldwide. But it isn't just a kind of an accidental vestige of monarchy that crept into our Constitution. The Founding Fathers thought of it as a check and balance. Indeed, it is part of our checks and balances system, just like impeachment or the veto or the spending power of Congress. It's a formal recognition of what we all know, and that is courts and judges and juries are not perfect. They make mistakes, and so does the legislative branch. They write bad laws every now and then. They're not written well. They're not enforced well. And so this is an executive power that's one of several checks on the other two branches of government. And so I think that is important to say up front here. There's a tendency to think of this as some kind of a ancient thing from kings that somehow or another snuck its way in the Constitution, mm-hmm. and nothing could be further from the truth. This
just
is
just the opposite.
Very, very consciously part of our system of government.
Well, in theory, it sounds fantastic. Of course, when you apply it to real life, there can be all kinds of interesting cases, as you have said. We're talking with Professor P.S. Ruckman about about pardons in general, be them presidential or gubernatorial. And Professor, I'm going to ask you two more questions, then we're going to get to the governor of Mississippi. What is the most, in your opinion, one of the most outrageous pardons? You know, one of the, oh my gosh, I can't believe he did that.
I'm so totally the wrong person to ask this because I know so many of them. I mean, I could talk for 3 hours.
Let me just use a random one. Let's use a random one.
A guy puts his head over the foot of a 7-year-old girl after molesting her sexually, and so she drowns in a drainage ditch. And you know, how does a person like that get executive clemency? Or a guy who tortured and murdered 60 people, one at a time. Or a guy, or the people who sprayed the House of Representatives with bullets and hit 5 congressmen. Or the guy who caused a financial panic on Wall Street and drank a soapy liquid to simulate a death-like state was pardoned. And then, of course, after he was pardoned, got well and outlived the president who pardoned him. I mean, I can just go on and on and on and on, and we forget these things.
Well,
at the time, they're considered the greatest things ever, but quickly they just vanish from our
What
from our
happened?
Mind.
Let's take that horrible case of the man who killed the 7-year-old.
What
in the world would prompt? Who did it, first of all? And what?
Yeah, there's an
the
episode
world?
All by itself, isn't it?
we could do 3 hours on that. What in
well,
the world
was,
prompted whoever it was that did it? Whomever.
Well, he was sentenced to be executed originally, and then there was some people raised doubt about his sanity, so his sentence was commuted to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And then Gerald Ford came around and commuted that to life in prison with the possibility of parole, and then he got parole.
Do we know why he did it? Do we know why President Ford did it? What was his? How did this guy get it and not some other person that could truly deserve it?
Well, that's always the question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to say, too, and this will maybe lead us into Barber pretty well. It just kind of as a public service whenever I talk about this topic. People really need to know. Most, and by most, I mean 95%+ of all presidential pardons and gubernatorial pardons, 95%+ of them, are completely non-controversial. They're given to people who served, who committed minor offenses, usually years, sometimes decades ago. They've served their time, if they had any time at all,
mm-hmm.
and they've lived a good life, if you will. They've passed the scrutiny of a parole board or a parole commission or the FBI. And the pardon simply restores their rights to serve on a jury, to vote, as you mentioned, own a hunting rifle. And that's the typical presidential and gubernatorial pardon, and there is zero controversy about those. And so, and that's not to minimize, kind of what we're going to be talking about, but
right. But
it does need to be kind of kept in that context. And see, sometimes people think, well, every time a president, if they pardon someone, it's this huge political risk. That's totally false. That's completely false.
Exactly. Well,
President Obama has pardoned 27, 28 people. You probably can't name one. I research this stuff as much as anyone. I can't even name one off the top of my head. I mean, I could go look it up, but they're completely non-controversial, most of them.
Well, getting back to President Ford, when he let out the child killer, what prompted him? I mean, how did that happen?
Well, presidents don't have to give reasons for – and actually, if President Ford were here, he would say, well, I didn't let him out. I commuted the sentence to the possibility of parole, and some parole board let him out.
How did his name get in front of President Ford, and so many others don't get in front of the president? What is the process? Do you just send it in? Do you have to know somebody? I mean
at the federal level, you have an informal and a formal process. The formal process is you fill out an application, they send it to the FBI. They do research. They work with the Deputy Attorney General, actually the Office of the Pardon Attorney, and the Deputy Attorney General, and they make a recommendation to the President. So that's the formal. Then the informal path is kind of what you just referred to. You know, you meet someone at a cocktail party, you do some lobbying, you know, you pass an envelope here or there, that kind of stuff. And, you know, a pardon can go either of those routes.
Are there any sort of guidelines? I mean, I'm so baffled by this. I don't know what to say. What the hell is a perfect title?
There are guidelines that the Department of Justice uses, and a lot of states use, but the ones the Department of Justice has, they're not restrictions on the president. So, for example, they say you should wait 5 years after you commit your offense to be able to apply, or I'm sorry, 5 years after you serve to apply for the pardon. That's what the Department of Justice says. But the president can pardon anyone anytime he wants to. There are no restrictions on the president. So administrative bodies do every now and then have rules and guidelines, but whether or not they restrict the person who has the pardon power is a completely different question.
Boy, this is so bizarre. It really is. I just can't imagine President Ford looking at this guy's history, you know, seeing that he put his foot on a 7-year-old's neck, killing her, and then said, I'll reduce it to possibility of parole.
Well, think of Abraham Lincoln, one of the most beloved presidents of many Americans. I know some Americans aren't too fond of him, but Andrew Johnson pardoned several of the conspirators in the Abraham Lincoln assassination. The person who formed the plot, the person who held the door open for John Wilkes Booth to get out and get to the horse, and the doctor that set the leg of John Wilkes Booth. I mean, we're talking, some of the most high crimes in American history.
Right.
And pardons are right there.
Wow, that is... That's just bizarre. Somebody in chat, Vicky, wrote, Ford probably fell on the wrong button. That probably exactly what happened. Okay, let's get to the former governor of Mississippi, Haley Barbour. This, to me, is so outrageous. Most of the pardons that he gave out were not controversial, like you said.
That's right.
People need to understand is a lot of the pardons, the people were already out of prison.
That's right.
They were out. The purpose of those pardons was, like you said, Professor, to wipe the record clean so they can do things like serve on a jury, they can vote, they can hunt, as the wonderful governor said. But there were a few of them that were just jaw-dropping. It just knocked the wind out of you. We're talking with Professor P.S. Ruckman. He is a doctor in political science, and he is one of the top experts in the world on pardons. And we're talking about former Governor Haley Barbour's pardons of killers. Now, one of the people he pardoned was David Gatlin, a convicted wife murderer. He earned good behavior points by working as a trustee at the governor's mansion.
Right.
Four of these people released this weekend worked at the mansion. Now, and there's some pretty heavy-duty ones here. Karen Irby, a Jackson socialite convicted of killing two doctors in a DUI crash. Ernest Favre, the brother of ex-NFL great Brett Favre, killed his best friend in a drunk driving accident. David Gatlin, like I said, murdered his wife. Let's talk about David Gatlin, first and foremost.
Okay.
Killed his wife. He went from in prison to freedom with his criminal record wiped clean. How did that happen?
Well, I tell you, in terms of when people look at this, you know, they right away want to know, journalists often, you know, is this unprecedented or, you know, is this unusual? And for this case, for this badge, in my mind, it's not unusual to see end of pardon terms, and it's not the most unusual thing to see one or two people maybe who committed a violent crime to be pardoned. But what makes this unusual is the large number of people that Barber pardoned, and also the high percentage of them that committed violent crimes. That is very unusual. I've gone through each and every one of the clemency warrants, and it's very heavy-handed on murder, manslaughter, as you mentioned, vehicular homicide, aggravated assault, rape, statutory rape. I mean, it's very heavy-handed on that.
But how
and
many people, were most of those people already out anyway? or not?
I don't know the terminology in Mississippi. That's what kind of makes this problematic. I noticed in only one form did he use the phrase commutation of sentence. That was with a socialite you just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed on dozens of others, they were still serving, or they were on probation, or they were in some program. And so the clemency actually cut their sentence short. Now, in my mind, that's a commutation of sentence. That's not a pardon.
Yeah.
So I don't really quite understand how they do that in Mississippi.
Well, there's a lot of things I don't understand about Mississippi, but that's a whole other show as well.
The Gatlin thing, that's been out there for some time. And, you know, my memory is, unless I'm confusing him, he's the one that shot his wife kind of like in broad daylight, right?
Yeah.
She was sitting in
a
car.
Yeah, I mean, he's
yeah.
Like just a cold-blooded killer.
Well,
how? Okay, I need you to help me here, because I'm going to just chew my arms up to my elbows unless I understand this, because it's driving me crazy. Professor Ruckman, how, first of all, did that guy's name, that killer's name, get in front of Governor Barber for a pardon? Tell me exactly how that happened.
But the process for that particular guy? That I couldn't tell you. I don't know if he applied, or actually I don't even know if he was one of the governor's mansion's persons or not.
So it could have been he just knew somebody who knew somebody because he worked at the governor's mansion, and it was that simple, right?
But here, yeah, it could have been. But look, here's the way to kind of work your way through a case like this. You could take the position a person who commits a crime like that should never be pardoned. Period. Okay,
mm-hmm.
That you could take that position, and I think reasonably enough. But I think there's an alternative that you know, you may not agree with, but I think you would agree it's more acceptable. And namely, that would be you pardon the guy. You're the governor. You pardon the guy, and then you hold a press conference and you tell people why you did it. You give in great detail.
Exactly.
And they're still going to be mad at you. You're still going to make some people angry.
Right.
But at least it will look like it was done thoughtfully, and you had reasons to, you know, and that they were legitimate, even if you disagree with them, you know, that kind of thing. That's the thing about, you know, Barber's trying to focus on, already he's trying to focus on the substance of these decisions, and I think there'll be time enough for that. Right now, rightfully so, the focus is on the way he did it.
Mm-hmm.
At the last second, after pardoning hardly anyone for 8 years, that is despicable, I would say, because for 8 years he's been sitting on recommendations and doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that time, people were not getting jobs. They were suffering the disabilities because they didn't have, and for 8 years they suffered because of him doing that.
Right.
And that's despicable. So
it is.
But
yeah.
So even if he explained, I have a feeling even if he explained his decision making with respect to Mr. Gatlin, there would still be people angry. Still, it would have been much more respectable.
What could be a reason? What I mean, what the hell? He worked at my mansion. I liked him. He was a nice guy. What could there be? Help me here. Make something up. Make it so I don't go nuts here trying to figure this out.
Well, first of all, I have to know this. Are you the kind of person who would say a person who commits a murder like that should never, ever be pardoned?
I would say they should never be pardoned. I'm not necessarily saying paroled, but never pardoned.
Yeah. Okay, well, if... should they be paroled then?
Well, it all depends on the circumstance. You know, that would be too hard to say. Not paroled ever, but again, a circumstance may arise. But go ahead.
All right, let's put it this way. If I were looking at a presidential pardon of a convicted murderer, here's what I would expect to see. I would expect to see some reference to a mitigating circumstance like age.
Mm-hmm.
They were young when they committed it.
Right.
Or some type of psychological duress or incapacitation of mental state. Good time, good behavior, evidence of reformation, graduated, help other students, started a drug treatment program while they were in prison. Recommendation, a key one would be recommendation from judges and prosecutors. Yeah, that's the first thing you would look for. Look to see if the judge or the prosecutor in the case recommended clemency.
And do we know if any of those did in this particular case?
Well, I mean, that those are the things people are going to be looking for.
Okay,
I can assure
you
of that.
Don't know that yet. Okay.
And sometimes members of the jury will recommend clemency as well.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the things I would expect to see floating behind that. And if I didn't see those things, that would be a gigantic red flag.
Right. Somebody paid off. There was some weird, you know, quid pro quo thing. I'm saying it, not you. I'll say it.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, not I understand. We're talking with Professor Ruckman. He is a professor, P.S. Ruckman, from Illinois. He is a doctorate in political science and one of the few people who is an expert on pardons, gubernatorial and presidential. And this is just absolutely fascinating. I have a couple of questions here from the chat room. Let me run up here really quickly. What is the average number of pardons given by an outgoing governor compared to what Barber has done? In other words, I think you may have covered that already. He did 200 at the last minute. That's really unusual, right?
Yeah, the scope of that is pretty large, yes. When you're generalizing about all 50 state governors, that's pretty tough to do because every state does whatever it wants to. But as I said up front, last-minute pardons are not that unusual. But this many, after not using the power at all for 8 years, that is freakish.
Some of these people were sick. You know that you have to look at things like that. You have to have some compassion as a human being. You know, if they were sick for a long time and he made them suffer, that is not good at all.
Yeah, you got to wonder.
I mean, I know you can't get into his mind, but you've seen this happen. Do they just think they can get away with it and no one's going to notice?
No, I can get into his mind. I don't mind doing that at all. I think this is a very simple case of you had a guy who was a Southern Republican governor, and he was a potential Republican presidential nominee.
Mm-hmm.
And the people he was in the potential field with were people like also governors like Huckabee and Romney. And in that particular cycle, Huckabee was getting beaten up for pardoning people with disastrous results. And the other governors were bragging about how they hadn't pardoned anyone. And so that was Barber's competition, so to speak. And so as long as that was on the plate, as long as he was considering being a potential Republican nominee, then I think he just didn't really give a rip about pardons.
Right.
Okay, once that is off of the plate, he's nearing the end of his term, he's probably thinking, well, I can pardon these people. It's not like anyone can do anything about it. It'll draw a lot of attention to me. It'll make me very popular on the speaking tour, which he's doing, and you know, of course, boost sales for his upcoming book. So I think it's a very practical kind of thing. If you just look at his action as selfish, politically calculated, and callous, I think it's very simple to explain.
Boy, that's interesting. I mean, any controversy will usually push up book sales and usually push up ticket sales to your speeches.
Sure.
and your costs. That's very, if that is part of the reason, that's very calculating. Has there been a case in recent times, I'm not talking a couple hundred years ago, I mean in modern times, where it has been proven that there has been money exchanged or a favor exchanged?
I can think of the guy I just mentioned who drank the liquid to simulate death.
Yes,
it turned out about a year or so later, Congress uncovered evidence to suggest that he had paid $200,000 to the U.S. Attorney General, who had actually been pushing to get the president to pardon him. So yeah, that wouldn't be too terribly unusual.
To me, it's the arrogance of it, because they do have the right. They can pardon anybody they want, the president or a governor leaving office, and there's a reason, like you said, for that power. There's a reason they don't have to go through a committee or ask anybody or get, you know, the Senate or whatever to agree with them. There is a reason. It's a check and balance, and I get it. But Professor Ruckman, the sheer arrogance of former Governor Barber's pardons is what baffles me. Something is going to happen, and he is going to be caught up in something, because this is just too ugly to simply be push up my book sales. I just can't buy it. There's something going on here.
Well, again, I would say it's also the combination of he had the weight of being a Republican nominee off of his shoulder too, and so once that was lifted, then he could take an interest in pardons. Look, he had the example of Bill Clinton to follow. You know, what kind of trouble did Bill Clinton get in? Nothing. He became more popular than he ever was.
Well, that's true. And you can pretty much trace a bunch of his pardons, or at least one of them, to his brother. You know, he did a favor to his brother. I mean, and that's not illegal. It's not illegal to do favors to pardon people. That's their right. But I'm pretty sure it's illegal if there is money promised or a job promised. I'm pretty sure that's illegal.
Well, I thought it was kind of interesting that Barber's, I think, former speechwriter wrote an editorial defending him, and the basic line of her defense was, he's a good guy, he's really smart, and what he did was not illegal. That was the defense, which is not a very strong
offense. That's not a very compelling
defense.
That's like, I mean, good Lord, that's about as weak as you can. That's better not to even write anything than to write that, just because illegal doesn't mean it should be done. You know, neither walking down the street in your underpants, but you're not going to do it. Good Lord. Okay, Professor Ruckman, let's talk. This is just so fascinating to me. I've decided that Barber is nuts, and just, I don't know what the hell he was thinking, but he did it. And this story is not going to go away, because I think the people of Mississippi are angry, and there'll be people following this for a long, long time. But Professor Ruckman, let's go back to some earlier pardons. I want to hear about the strange ones, the weird ones, the ones that do make your jaw drop and you go, whoa, what is going on? Give us some more of those, please.
Well, I'm in a situation where I've written a book which I don't have a contract for, and I'm writing a book which I do have a contract for. And the first book is the one where I've written about what I call notable presidential pardons, just kind of the weird, the wild, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And the jaw droppers, I find there are three or four of them every generation. Mm-hmm. And some of them are, this is kind of a fun, interesting way to do it, is I could name some people that you've heard of, but you may not be aware that they've been pardoned.
Okay.
This is kind of another way of making the same point. And, this is a generational thing sometimes, you know, because, you know, people are born in certain ages and whatnot. But we'll just see. George Steinbrenner. Do you know that name?
Pardoned? What did he do?
Well, there you go, right there. Okay.
I mean, he was an arrogant ass, but I don't think that's illegal.
How about the name Peter Yarrow? Do you know that name?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Peter, Paul, and Mary guy.
That's right. How about Jimmy the Greek?
Well, yeah, the gambler.
Yeah, there you go. So I can just rattle off names like this, and you've heard of them, but you're not aware. Another way I could do this is name famous kind of crimes that are just kind of so, you know, over the top that you wouldn't think a person like that could be pardoned, like spraying the chambers of the House of Representatives with bullets.
Right.
Those people, they didn't even say they were sorry. They never asked for pardon. They just said, we wish we'd killed more people. And that's the way they lived in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy Carter commuted their sentences so they could go home. One of them stood in the airport here in Chicagoland and tore the pardon up into pieces and hopped on the plane and flew off to Puerto Rico.
You
just look at that and go, how did that happen?
Jimmy Carter is just too nice. He thinks that all humans are good, and if you give everybody a chance, and that's just not the case. You know, there's just people that need to be locked up.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, absolutely. If they would just make me leader of the world, I could solve all of this really quickly.
I can think of one of my favorite pardons is a guy who was kind of really one of the first kind of Bonnie and Clyde kind of figures. Mm-hmm. He status. because he was robbing the big boys in the middle of broad daylight and whatnot. And along the way, he murdered a police officer. Mm-hmm. And I think after that, he did a Brinks armored truck he robbed. Well, they finally caught him. The problem is actually they would catch him, and he kept escaping, which kind of added to his aura as a folk hero. Well, right. Eventually, Connecticut caught him, and they wanted to execute him. And his lawyer said, well, you can't execute him because he has a 20-year sentence in a federal penitentiary he has to serve first. Mm-hmm. And so the great punchline of the story is the president pardoned him for the federal offense so he could be executed for the state offense.
That's where a pardon works, right there.
He was literally in his jail cell refusing to touch the pardon. You know, I'm not going to accept that because he knew. And so the constitutional question that reached the Supreme Court was whether or not a person can refuse a pardon. Mm-hmm. And so, again, at the time, oh, my Lord, people thought that was just the biggest case ever. I found a case actually in the administration of Grover Cleveland that was remarkably similar to Scooter Libby, so similar, so many different dimensions, that I actually wrote about it in National Review and more or less predicted that Libby would not be pardoned, but mm-hmm. that the president would use clemency. And I was really one of only two people who were doing that. Because everyone was saying, oh, he's going to be pardoned or he's going to be sent to prison. And there were only two of us who were saying, no, that's not true. There are several things the president can do. And so, like I say, mafia, gangland, executioners, vampires.
What's a vampire? Let's do one more story. What's a vampire pardon?
Well, the vampire was caught in the bottom of a ship, sucking blood out of lifeless bodies and sentenced to death. And Ulysses Grant commuted the sentence to life in prison, whereupon he proceeded to murder some more people while he was in prison. So,
lovely.
That wasn't a very successful pardon.
No, certainly wasn't.
But any other big events in American history, the Whiskey Rebellion, Freeze Rebellion, a lot of these events in history, pardons are around them one way or another. Mm-hmm. And we just have a tendency to forget.
Well, Professor Ruckman, this has been absolutely fascinating, and I could do a whole three-hour show on the pardons of our presidents and our former governors, because it sounds like there is a lot to talk about. Professor P.S. Ruckman, give us your website again, and anything else that you would like to tell us about before you sign off, the floor is yours.
Well, the website is pardonpower.com, and I follow presidential pardons. For the most part, when they're actually happening, but I do keep track of state pardons as well. And there's a nice index over on the right, so whatever state a person is in, they can just click on that state and see what I've been writing about or what's been going on in that state for the last several years since we've been up. And if you visit that site, you'll be visiting a site that's regularly visited by the Department of Justice, the Executive Office of the President, and numerous state legislatures. So
and
you'll be in good company.
You'll be in good company. And now we can add Web Sleuth members and Web Sleuth Radio listeners to your website. Professor P.S. Ruckman, thank you so much for joining us tonight. You have just been a treasure trove of information, and we will have you on again very soon, I'm sure.
That'd be my pleasure. Stay in touch.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. From one what the hell is going on to the next what the hell is going on. It's time to talk about our favorite, if we can call her favorite, crazy person who is not really crazy at all, and that is Casey Anthony. Her psych evaluation, a lot of it was released, and two doctors evaluated her, Dr. Jeffrey Dangziger and William Wheats, I believe is how it's pronounced. Now, the DSM-V5 does not have a category for pure evil. That's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders 5. That's the only category I think she falls under, is pure evil. On the phone with us now is Dr. Glenn Lipson. He is a forensic psychologist, an amazing man who's been on our show before. Dr. Lipson, welcome so much. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And also joining us is true crime author Donna Kaufman, whose latest book with Dr. Cyril Wecht is called From Crime Scene to Courtroom, and it does feature the Casey Anthony case. Donna, welcome, my dear.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't even know where to begin, because this, every time Casey Anthony every, you know, anytime a portion of her DNA shows up somewhere, there is craziness right behind it, including this psych evaluation. Dr. Lipson, you are familiar with Casey Anthony, like the rest of us are. I mean, you know, we don't have any necessarily inside information, but I don't think it was that unheard of for everybody to assume that Casey Anthony had to be some sort of sociopath or have some sort of personality disorder, not a mental illness, but a personality disorder. And guess what? According to this psych evaluation, she does not. Thoughts?
Well, a couple thoughts about that. Number one, people who tend to get hired by the defense tend to be experts who have a bias in a way of explaining behavior away. So they tend to be very liberal in terms of the application of sympathy. So they tend to have that bias, and then people then end up being retained by the prosecutors who really have more of a bias to hold people responsible and see a lot more motivation than pathology in terms of how people act. So there's a couple problems here. One is the relying on the tests. And Dr. Danziger relied a lot on what we call the MMPI,
mm-hmm.
which stands for the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory.
Now, isn't that supposed to be an amazing test that can really just zero in on a person's personality disorder?
It is one tool that you need to integrate with everything else, including
okay.
behavior and a number of other things. I have done criminal evaluations before where I get a normal profile from someone, and afterwards I will look at the person and I will say to them, this makes no sense to me. And it makes no sense to me because if you're in jail, if you have committed a homicide, if you're potentially facing a lifetime of consequences regarding being jailed or potentially
mm-hmm.
being executed, I expect any normal person to look upset and troubled.
Right.
These instruments rely on people giving an opinion or a view of themselves. If someone's view of themselves is not realistic or if it's fanciful, that's what you're going to have on that test to interpret.
Okay.
So let me give you an example.
Yes.
A case that some of your listeners might know of that I testified in was a case of Commander Palm, who killed the neighborhood bully.
Okay, I remember that, yes.
This is covered worldwide. When he did the MMPI, it looked normal, and then I asked him to, because he thought I wanted to see how he had viewed himself most of his life.
Mm-hmm.
When I said, fill it out in terms of how you are today, then I was able to see the pathology.
Mm-hmm.
So when you read the depositions and you have experts relying on the testimony, they are relying too much on testing and data that can really be based on someone not being truthful with themselves.
Right.
Someone who wants to present to the world another way.
Okay. But I understand, and believe me, you are the doctor here. I am not. What are the initials again? MMPI?
Yeah, the MMPI, and now it's -2. It's in the second edition.
Okay. I understand that it is built around the understanding that people are going to lie about themselves, and it has, you know, built in tricks, if you will, to be able to see when somebody is lying and therefore be able to tell their true self. No? Yes?
Yes, there are elements of that, but it has scales that are based on people mostly faking bad,
mm-hmm.
exaggerating in a way where they endorse symptoms that are highly unlikely. They're not specific to the different scales. It is less exact at picking up on people who fake good. So
okay.
if you were to look at the average MMPI for someone who's going for a job,
mm-hmm.
or for someone who is involved in a custody dispute, that MMPI is going to look much more normal because you're not going to have people claiming what's going on with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are a couple scales, because interpreting it is a bit of an art, there are a couple scales that help us understand if someone's claiming to be too virtuous. There are some scales that help us understand if someone is hysterically positive about everything.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes when people fake good, they don't go to that extent.
Got that.
It is better if I'm evaluating someone who wants to claim I was not competent when I committed a crime because I couldn't tell right from wrong, I was psychotic. Then it's easier to get someone who's exaggerating than someone who's taking a test and they're trying to look normal.
Understood. Oh, wow. This is so helpful. I am so grateful that you are here, Dr. Lipson. We're talking to Dr. Glenn Lipson about Casey Anthony's psych evaluation. Dr. Lipson, we'll come back to you in just a moment. Let's go to true crime author Donna Kaufman, who always has an interesting opinion. What do you think about Casey Anthony being basically normal, is kind of what they're saying, according to her defense attorney's doctor's psych evaluation?
Well, we aren't privy to the same evaluations that different doctors gave her from the prosecution side. This is only the defense depositions that have been released. And like Glenn said, you know, these doctors want to please who hires them, even if they're working pro bono. But in this case, remember during the trial, there was a question as at the end of the defense case whether Casey was going to take the stand.
Right.
And she was giving all sorts of indications and facial gestures that she was going to. And there was a real fear that she would. And there was a belief behind the scenes that her attorneys were saying, that's not a good idea. We got this under control. You're only going to hurt yourself. And
mm-hmm.
she was such an egomaniac that they feared she would overrule them, because it is her decision. So these two doctors came into the picture to do sort of emergency evaluations, and they had looked at the whole case file, but they really didn't know the case. One
mm-hmm.
was from Boca, and I can't remember where the other one was from, but they're not from Orlando. They were chosen because they didn't know a lot about the case.
Okay.
So things that she told them, which we who know the case know are proven lies, just went right over their head. Like she told them about her high school years and, you know, her struggles in school, and but she was a good student and she graduated. And hey, stop everything. She didn't graduate.
Right.
She dropped out of school, as we know, and didn't bother telling her mom, who had a graduation party for her nonetheless, even though, you know, Casey was short of that degree. So there were things that, as I reviewed the information, that I could see where they would have been hoaxed, and how could they have known? And, you know, what? Maybe it didn't matter. But basically what they were trying to do is make sure that she didn't have autism, Asperger syndrome, as some sort of mental illness, diagnostic mental illness that would have prevented her from taking the stand and making that decision.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from the chat room. It's a very good one from Why Not Divine. Did Wietz and Dangziger give her the tests themselves or only review the tests and interpret them? Do you know?
I'm sorry, when you say tests, what are you talking about?
Well, the psych evaluations. Were they given to them and then they interpreted them, or did they give them to her themselves? Did they actually administer the test?
The administering a test means you make sure someone understands the instructions and you watch them fill in the bubbles,
mm-hmm.
at least in terms of a test like the NMPI. So these tests are usually administered by the experts. One of the issues you have when you are retained in a matter like this is that you don't end up being spoon-fed by the side that retained you.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is you don't believe when someone potentially is a liar and someone has a history of lying about numerous events in their life, employment, graduation, etc. You verify by obtaining other records that will help you make some determination of how much you could rely on what someone's telling you. In
okay,
addition,
so you do a little background
ahead of time.
Right.
That's the background. If you do that ahead of time, you could ask them and then confront them about why they're giving you information which is not truthful. So what happens often is you could get called in, assigned an evaluation, and only be given so much by the defense attorney because they're looking at specific questions.
So
example,
the defense attorney can literally skew this test result by withholding pertinent information.
They skew our ability to interpret the results by withholding information because the interpretation of the results relies on integrating all the information we have, very much like Web Sleuth listeners and participants do. They try to get a hold of all the information they can, and you make it available to them.
Exactly.
When you're an expert, you have to do the same thing. You have to get all this additional information and go over it.
Wouldn't you expect two professionals hired by a defense attorney to request all of this information, or to protect themselves professionally, do they just rely on what the defense tells them so they can have kind of a little bit of wiggle room here in case they're found out?
Can I answer that?
Yes,
they
Donna Kaufman, true crime author.
They had all the interviews of all the other people, so they knew what Jesse Grund was saying. They knew what the family was saying, and so they really did a lot of homework. But this case is so enormous, and the minutia is so overwhelming that no one should be expected to know every detail like, well, we do.
Exactly.
But, these guys are coming fresh into this case. They did a pretty good job given what they were asked to assess. And one of the things they were trying to determine as well was, could she have had a seizure disorder that prevented her from making good decisions and might affect whether she takes the stand? And there were, Jesse Grund said that he, I think it was Jesse Grund, remembered her having a seizure once. Her mom, Cindy, also witnessed a seizure. She had his hospital records of CAT scan and that kind of stuff, but the doctors didn't have access to those or didn't ask for those records.
Mm-hmm.
What they could do is say, there was reports of a seizure. We don't know if she really has a seizure problem, but she's not on any medication. So that kind of tells you that, it wasn't a seizure seizure. Yeah, it wasn't something that would have affected her ability to testify if she was going to testify.
Donna, is it, perhaps you know this, are there going to be any more of these evaluations released from the prosecution side? I'm not quite sure. Was this the defense attorneys that released it, or was this under the Sunshine Law in Florida? I'm not sure how exactly these came about.
Yeah, I'd like to know, too. I'd be very interested in seeing what the prosecution doctors looked at, and these two doctors, Danziger and White, referenced that there were other reports. But remember, the basic thing is I don't know, and I don't know who requested those. I'm not sure who requested them to put them online. WBDO has a website that has the information, so you can go there and read them yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very lengthy and they're very detailed. So I don't know.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see if some of the prosecution's evaluations will be released now that the defense attorneys have been released, because that might balance it out just a little bit. Dr. Lipson. Oh, go ahead, Donna Kaufman.
I'm sorry. It would be specifically interesting to find out what the question of molestation would have surfaced in the initial round of interviews, because that was a very key point. Of course, when these two doctors were hired, we were well into the case, and it was very apparent that this was going to be, let's blame it on George.
Mm-hmm.
So, of what they were asking was to determine the accuracy of Casey's charges against George.
Right, exactly. And I think a lot of us agree that those charges were absolutely false. Dr. Lipson, in your practice, can a sociopath really truly fool a good doctor?
Definitely. The main book on sociopathy was written by a person by the name of Harvey Kleckley, and it was called The Mask of Sanity.
Right, I know that book
very
well.
The reason it was called The Mask of Sanity was his comment that to many people, someone who is sociopathic will look normal.
Mm-hmm.
That they had the ability to feign empathy, to feign being like everyone else, but underneath that is a coldness that means they don't really connect with others and all they do is exploit others. They're not really capable of empathy. But they could appear to be normal.
And so they could take the MMPI, I keep forgetting the initials, they could take that test, and a sociopath, even with the built-in trips that are built into the test, would be good enough to fool it and fool the doctors.
Correct, and that's why there have other tests have been developed. And the reason is the MMPI-2 requires the person to report their perceptions of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If you start with the assumption that the person isn't honest with what they're reporting, then it makes it difficult to rely on the results. So you need to get information from a number of other sources.
Right. So you can't just rely. You can't just take that test, pop it in, and say, "Oh, this is the diagnosis." You have to pull from all other different sources of information. Right.
Correct. And if you were to use some of the software programs that experts use to score them, all of them have a paragraph in them that says this is a source of inferences, a source of hypotheses, of things to consider that you need to take into account with background history, other tests, and other information before reaching a diagnosis. The MMPI was designed in the late 30s, early 40s, with the idea that it would diagnose you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the scales have names that go back to the diagnostic criteria in those days, such as hypochondriasis, psychasthenia, those types of things, which are not diagnoses now. And the test never succeeded in doing that. But we do notice significant differences with people with different diagnoses if we integrate it with other clinical and historical information.
And that's where we are at today. We cannot rely totally on the MMPI. Dr. Lipson, we're talking with Dr. Glenn Lipson, a forensic psychologist, among many other amazing abilities that he has, and we'll be talking about his website here in just a little bit. Dr. Lipson, how does a person become a sociopath? Are they born? Are they made? Is it a combination of the two? How does this work?
That's a good question. And what we end up with is nature and nurture combined, and that is a lot of the research on people who are sociopaths suggests that they don't respond to stimuli the same way. They're under arouse. They have to go out and seek excitement. There is that element, and then there are potentially issues that happen in terms of the forming of attachments to people that allow them to have empathy and to love. So there's a combination of nature and nurture that we believe underscores someone becoming a sociopath. So it isn't only the bad seed, it's the ground that seed is placed in.
So you could be born a bad seed, but if you have a wonderful, nurturing, loving home, that could prevent the seed from sprouting and growing, so to speak, correct?
Correct. There's a possibility to help people learn compassion. There's the possibility to help people through a healthy attachment grow more normally.
How young do you have to catch people to do this? I mean, let me ask you this. Let me back up a moment. Isn't there a test now where they can show parts of the brain that you can kind of determine that they might have this sociopathic seed planted in them? Isn't there a way to kind of see if your brain is wired differently and you have a chance of becoming a sociopath?
Well, the problem with some of the more recent neuroimaging studies are they're not absolute.
Mm-hmm.
But if you find that lack of empathy and you show faces and you don't, the brain doesn't fire the same way, this is using fMRIs, which are functional magnetic resonant imaging, those types of things, and people don't respond to stimuli normally, you don't know whether you have autism, whether you have sociopathy. There could be any number of things going on that take the need to help this person have a better connection with the world.
Let's say in a perfect world, you have a test. You have an MRI test or a CAT scan test that can pinpoint the part of the brain that whether you can tell someone's a sociopath or not. Okay, let's say we have someone, a baby, and the baby has that seed of being a sociopath. How soon do you have to start developing that child? Is it immediate, or can somebody be a sociopath and not have a very good upbringing and then, say, maybe at 7 or 8 years old, go into a loving family and be able to change?
That there isn't an answer to that question. I mean, it's a good question. There are some people who you get at 7 or 8 who you're able to change, and there are some that are less able, because there's a lot of different elements involved with attachment, which is threshold of responsiveness, 7 or 8 traits that all interact that influence how you respond to different environments and in different families. So it's difficult. What we do know from the literature with sexually violent predators and the number is that if you are high enough on some of our sociopathy measures, the likelihood is that you will never change.
Right.
If you commit a crime, that what you'll succeed in doing is gaming treatment and fooling people potentially, but the likelihood of you ever attaching to someone in a healthy way is relatively small. And that's the belief that keeps mentally disordered offenders and sexually violent predators continuing to be locked up in different states.
Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing. We need that. Dr. Lipson, I don't know if you're able to answer this, and if you can't, I understand completely. But you've looked at the Casey Anthony case like we all have. In your professional opinion, if you had to just guess, what went wrong? Why did she turn out this way?
I don't know. I don't know the case in that level of depth. I mean, Donna probably has a better sense of that, since she has lived through this case for years at a really in-depth level. Obviously, there's I don't know what happened in that family, but there's that element. There's also elements of who she is. There's a number of other things.
Mm-hmm.
When we get hired as experts, there's a couple of questions that a defense attorney will ask. One is, if someone isn't responding in a normal way, you'll sometimes ask if they have a dissociative disorder. And we used to call that multiple personality disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Why? And with some people, they look normal. In other cases, they look like someone totally different. And I have evaluated serial killers where, you know, the question is, do they have multiple personality disorder? Because they claim they never did it, despite the DNA and people who witnessed them committing the crimes. The other issue in this case is not knowing what goes on because of changes in neurological functioning potentially related to a seizure disorder. So you have Dr. Drew in his shows focusing on his belief that the real issue here is a seizure disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Seizure disorders are tricky because there's something called a sub-seizure disorder with something called limbic kindling, where the brain is just firing strangely. And one of the things they have found is that some people who've been diagnosed with diagnoses like borderline personality disorder and the like basically have a seizure disorder, and they get better when they're treated with anti-seizure medication.
Okay.
If in any state in this country you are found to have a seizure disorder that is significant by a physician, it is the responsibility of that physician to make sure you don't drive a car.
Right.
And the reason is, you don't want someone driving down the freeway having a seizure and losing control of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever is the history here of a seizure disorder, it's not of a level where we have a history of her having her license removed for 6 months to a year, studies and letters saying the seizure disorder is under control through medication.
Oh, I understand totally. Let's go to Donna Kaufman. Dr. Lipson kind of passed you the question here. What do you think went wrong?
Actually, oh, God forbid, you take her driver's license away, she wouldn't have a trunk to put a daughter in. And she
there you go.
God, that she didn't have, you know?
Exactly.
So, let me just work off something that Dr. Lipson said, which was in talking about sociopathy, all the earmarks for determining somebody is a sociopath can also be the same kinds of elements that would identify somebody who is a victim of sexual trauma, especially childhood sexual trauma, and could leave somebody detached, talking with a flat affect, somebody who doesn't, who is narcissistic, who is promiscuous. All those kinds of things can certainly argue sexual abuse, too. And that was such an important thing that these doctors had to determine. And they really had to just question her about it. And, you know, she really gave them the answers that the defense ended up promoting. And if these doctors really came into this case with no other knowledge about the case, they have to take this very seriously. Was she an abused child? Was she abused by her brother and her father, mostly her father, so she claims, to the extent that she was telling them she didn't know if perhaps her father was Kaylee's father, but
right.
No, the DNA during the course of the investigation proved that neither he nor Lee, who she never had actual sex with, so she says, were a biological father of Kaylee. So that's when she came up with this idea of, I was at a party and I drank two beers, and that's, you know, exactly what you would expect a decent woman to say. She only had two beers.
Right.
And then obviously somebody drugged her drink and she was passed out, and she must have been raped because her clothes were off when she woke up, and that's how she got pregnant. In the course of these interviews, though, there's also information that Cindy said, which was that that Casey had had a miscarriage previously. So, you know, who knows what's the truth there? And that's why this is such a puzzle, and why these doctors never testified and were so frustrated, really, by what they were hearing. One of them even said, Danziger even said he was losing sleep over, he lost weight, he was so bothered by the whole case that he wished he never got that call.
Well, he was worried. He didn't come out and say it, but reading between the lines, he didn't want to come out and say that George sexually abused Casey. And am I correct? That was the big troubling thing that he had, right?
Well, and it's a good question. I mean, if somebody is telling you this and they're giving the very detailed specifics that Casey was offering, it does make you wonder. And that is one of the things that the jury ended up also confused about, because they did not believe that George didn't cheat on Cindy, that woman. And if you lie about that, then you can also be a liar about other things.
Exactly.
And they never really could eliminate the possibility that he was a molester.
I agree 100%. Okay, my friends, we're going to have to wrap this up here. Donna Kaufman, true crime author, what's the name of your book, and what do you have coming up? Anything you'd like to tell us about?
Well, it's called From Crime Scene to Courtroom, and Casey Anthony is in there. It's a huge part of the book, and there's a lot of stuff in there that the jury never got to hear. And we go through everything through the post-acquittal. And also we talk about Michael Jackson and his death and the doctor who went on trial. So it's really up to date. It's up to the minute. And then there are some other cases in there that are just kind of mind-blowing, that aren't as big but are just twisty. And if you like mysteries and you like forensics and you like getting inside people's brains, you know, I think we've done a pretty good book there.
Oh, it is. I have to say it is fantastic. It's From Crime Scene to Courtroom with Dr. Cyril Weck and Donna Kaufman. Donna, thank you so much.
Oh,
again, you're
and Tricia did a blurb on the back.
Oh,
so
that's right.
A sealed book.
That's right. Web Sleuth has mentioned in it, and I did a little blurb on the back. It is a fantastic book. Thank you. Dr. Glenn Lipson, tell us about your website, sir.
Well, the website is makingrightchoices.com. The goal is to train people so they don't cross the lines and sexually abuse young students or older students, any students in kindergarten through college. And we've worked for 4 years to get a training together that we think can make a difference. And we're bringing it out at fairly little cost to districts and different organizations to try to make a dent in the about 10% of children that will get abused between kindergarten and 12th grade by employees in schools.
This is a
scandal that's larger than what went on in the Catholic Church because there are more students.
Right. And that's makingrightchoices.com.
You know, people listening to this should demand that their high school take part of a training like this, if not this one, because in the end, taxpayers end up paying for the giant checks that are written because there's not proper training.
The lawsuits. You're very right, Donna Kaufman. It's makingrightchoices.com with Dr. Glenn Lipson. Dr. Lipson, thank you so much. We're going to have you on again real soon, both of you. Thank you. You always make Web Sleuth Radio absolutely fascinating. I appreciate you both, and we will have you on again very, very soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tricia.
Bye-bye. Well, Kimster, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Kimster, it was a great show, wasn't it?
Yes, a lot of good
so.
Information. Yeah,
if I do
I like
say so
it.
Myself. Well, Kimster,
oh, I thought it was a great show.
Yes. Yes, I don't normally pat myself on the back, but basically I let the guests do all the work and then I take all the credit. That's how it works. So, okay, Kimster, we have a hot cold case that we need to talk about. Her name is Deborah Sue Lowe. This is the Web Sleuth hot cold case. Tell us about Deborah Sue, Kimster.
Well, this week's hot cold case is about Deborah Sue Lowe, and she's been missing since 1972. And this is a case where one of our members is actually her sister. And I'm going to go ahead and read what Debbie's sister wrote at websleuth.com. She said, "It started out as a normal day, February 29, 1972. My sister Debbie, my brother, and I all got ready to walk to school. We walked out the door, walked together to the end of the block together, and then my sister turned to the right. She smiled, waved, and said, 'I'll see you later,' and started the mile-long walk to her middle school. She was 13 years old, and we were too poor to afford to be able to ride the bus. We had moved to Florida the day before Christmas. My mother kept clippings of murders that were later linked to Gerard Schaefer. However, it was only a couple of years ago that we were able to get the Florida police to acknowledge that she was his type. My sister is somewhere as an unidentified missing remain. And while we search databases and everything that we can get our hands on, to date we have not located her. I was reading the forum," and she means websleuth.com, "and while police found things to link him to over 30 missing girls and women while in prison, he bragged that the count was actually over 100. I want to take a moment to thank for all the caring comments and attempts to help. Trust me, we the families of those missing and lost truly appreciate you." And that post was from Still Seek Answers. And I want to say that since she made that post, our members have really jumped in to try to help her. One of our moderators has just been phenomenal, Bessie. I have to mention her name because of all the work she's done on this case, trying to help Still Seek Answers find the remains of her sister from 1972. This is actually she posted in the Serial Killer Forum. We've talked about that being our newest, biggest forum. That's where you can find it. Right now, because she is the featured hot cold case of the week, you can go to our front page, which is right at www.websleuths.com. And up in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see her picture. And click here, push the click here, and you'll go right to the thread. And you'll get to meet Still Seek Answers and help her find her sister and bring her home.
And, Kim, sir, you bring up another great point that I have to hammer home a lot. And that is the family members of these missing people or murdered people, the ones that don't get any attention, when they come on Web Sleuths and they just see their loved one's name on a thread with three or four posts, it helps heal their heart. Their heart will never be totally healed, obviously, but it does such a tremendous amount of good for them to see that strangers care. So I really want to stress to everybody, even if you feel that you're not a good sleuther or you don't have time, just by coming on the cold cases and posting, I'm thinking of you, thank you, good luck, you can really, really make a difference. Am I right, Kimster?
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, she was so tickled to have her sister be the hot cold case of the week. And, you know, I think I can't remember. You guys will have to go and see the thread. But I know that she mentions in there, you know, her parents passing away without having answers. I can't remember if it's both of her parents or just one. But, I mean, she gets real personal as to what her journey has been like. And if you really want to see how much you can make a difference in a cold case, I really suggest that you guys just click here and go to that thread and meet her, because she's an awesome gal.
Debra Sue Lowe, go to our front page, which is websleuths.com, and you will see Debra Sue Lowe's case right there, and you can click on it, and that will take you right to the thread. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. It has been another fun edition and interesting and unusual edition of Web Sleuths Radio. I do appreciate you being here. Next week, my goal is, I don't know if I can do this, but I'm going to try and get some experts on about internet stalkers, because we have some, there's all kinds of weird, bizarre stories out there, and I want to separate the fact from the fiction. You know, do we really have to worry? What can they really do? I mean, believe me, I've had my share of them. I've had my house, the Google map posted of my house with detailed directions on how to get here. And so I get it. It's very scary. But then again, there are things you can do to protect yourself. So we're going to probably talk about internet stalkers, talk about the latest hot cases, the latest hot cold case from Web Sleuths, and so much more next week, 8 p.m. Eastern. It's Web Sleuths Radio, where we talk about true crime, current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.